This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Just in time for the holidays, a trade war. One toymaker story on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday, October 22nd. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The calendar proper says it's fall. The calendar, according to Wall Street, says it's earnings season. And in general, corporate America's doing all right. That sentiment, however, does not extend to Hasbro, to whom the third quarter was not kind. The Toymaker reported profits this morning that were well below estimates, a bit of earnings news that is actually the story of the trade war in miniature. It's a story of tariff announcements and delays and the chaos that makes it one company just ahead of its most important season. Marketplace's Mario Segarra tells the tale.
In the toy business, Christmas comes in the summer. That's when retailers start stocking up, getting shipments of toys from Hasbro and other manufacturers. They can buy those toys directly from Hasbro in the U.S., or they can import the toys from Hasbro's factories.
The retailer buys the product from them in China. The retailer puts it on their own ship. You know, this is Walmart, Target, the big guys. And they ship it to the U.S. themselves.
That's Linda Bolton-Weiser, a managing director at D.A. Davidson. She says a lot of retailers do this because it's cheaper. They get discounts and economies of scale. But the calculation was different this summer. Retailers were staring down a deadline, September 1st. That was when new tariffs were supposed to go into effect on toys and lots of other stuff coming from China. Tariffs the retailers did not want to pay.
Therefore, if you're a retailer between June and July, August, you're saying, oh my God, we have to change the order.
Retailers started canceling their shipments from China. They told Hasbro to import the toys itself and pay the tariffs too. Hasbro had to scramble.
They had to rush around and get whatever freight on the ocean from China, and they had to pay more.
But those tariffs everyone was freaking out about, they didn't go into effect in September. In August, the Trump administration delayed them until mid-December to save the holiday shopping season. But that didn't help Hasbro.
The toys have already been put on the boat. It takes 6 weeks on the boat. So it's too late. You can't switch it back, you know?
And that's the problem. It's not just the tariffs. It's the whole on-again, off-again thing, the uncertainty. Garrick Johnson is an equity research analyst at BMO Capital Markets.
Uncertainty is often worse than bad news because you do assume the worst. And not knowing how to plan, especially for a very seasonal business, has been very difficult.
And this won't be the end of it for Hasbro, because those tariffs are still slated to go into effect on December 15th, unless they don't. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Unless they don't, that's the name of the game, this whole trade war, isn't it? There is a new report out from the big consulting firm McKinsey saying that banks have to innovate and soon. Given market conditions and the threat of a global downturn, McKinsey says banks have to do better to make sure they are giving customers what they need. Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one for us.
According to the new report, banks allocate just a third of their information technology budgets to innovation, while financial technology companies, or fintechs, spend twice that on things like new peer-to-peer services and other products. Ashit Mehta is a senior partner at McKinsey & Company.
Economic conditions are not getting any better. And we're hoping this is more of a wake-up call for some banks to really think about their position, what it is they want to do differently.
He says more than half of the world's banks need to make changes or they're going to struggle during the next downturn. Myra Rodriguez-Valladares with the bank consulting firm MRV Associates says two areas where big banks can improve are technology and data analysis. Those have long been weak points for old traditional banks.
Data really is what's going to tell you what kinds of products and services you can continue to come up with.
She says there's growing competition among banks themselves and that Apple, Amazon, and other tech companies are offering more financial services. But independent banking analyst Nancy Bush says consumers' banking needs are so varied that there's room for all kinds.
Banking customers, I think, have done a very good job of segregating themselves according to what they want.
She says regional banks might struggle to keep up, but the big guys, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, Citi, they're going to be fine. In fact, they've been beating earnings expectations this year.
The problem, unless Amazon is going to establish physical banks somewhere or a physical point of contact, is that occasionally in your financial life, you need those.
Amazon's not there yet, but it also wasn't that long ago we used to think of that company as a bookseller. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Today, in foreign exchange trading as a proxy for political uncertainty, the British pound. Sterling took a bit of a tumble today after Parliament said thanks, but no thanks, to Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Brexit timetable that would have gotten the United Kingdom out of the European Union by Halloween. What comes next? Honestly, could not tell you. Wall Street on this Tuesday, mostly sideways. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It appears that WeWork founder Adam Neumann's days running the company that he brought oh so close to a blockbuster $47 billion initial public offering are over. In a deal that we mentioned quickly at the end of yesterday's program, WeWork is going to be taken over by a fund run by one of its big investors, the Japanese conglomerate SoftBank, and that at a valuation, by the way, of $8 billion. Neumann will get something like 1.7 billion simoleons to surrender his interest in the company. Maureen Fowler wrote about it all for the Wall Street Journal today. Maureen, good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me.
So this is just the price that it is to make Adam Neumann go away. Is that the gist of this?
That's definitely the gist of it. He'll have some role with the company. He's going to be involved as a consultant for about 4 years, but this gets him off the board and gets SoftBank control of the company.
Right. Why? This is kind of a basic question, but why does SoftBank, which is already $15 billion into this company in loans and investment, and a company that has seen its value drop by 40-something billion dollars, why does SoftBank want it?
It's a very good question. I mean, the idea, it does seem, is to salvage this gigantic investment. It's one of their largest, both for SoftBank Group and for this $100 billion vision fund. So it looks like it's just pretty hard to walk away from everything they've put in so far, these so-called sunk costs.
So this, once again, this is kind of a basic question, but they do kind of seem to surround this company at this moment. So as we said, a valuation of $47-something billion, which is now at $8 billion. SoftBank was in this, JP Morgan was in this, Goldman Sachs was one of its bankers for its IPO. Where do you suppose the due diligence was by these private investors that didn't uncover some of the things we saw when WeWork filed for its IPO?
There are going to be questions for a long time to come on who did the due diligence, what was the board's role. I mean, we understand that they signed off. Adam Neumann had taken a lot of money out of the company. It sold a lot of shares. Mm-hmm. He had taken some pretty significant loans against his stock. The company bought a very, very expensive private plane. There's a level of extravagance, I think, that shocked potential investors once it was made public in the filing. So we're definitely going to be unpacking this for a while.
So this has been a tricky year for IPOs. Forget WeWork, right? But, you know, there's Peloton and Smile Direct. And, of course, Uber has had its IPO problems. Is there a cautionary tale here? Have people learned their lesson? Or are we going to continue apace, do you think?
I think the cautionary tale is you know, the public investors are not just going to sit back and accept these companies that are still losing. They might be valued really high by private investors, but they're still losing a lot of money. They haven't figured out a business plan, and they are skeptical. Uber, you know, it's just gone down. Lyft has gone down. Peloton struggled. So I think there's going to be a question of, if you're one of these companies that hasn't gone out yet, do you even brave it, or do you know you have to really fix and change your business model before you attempt going public? And it seems very likely that that's going to be the case.
Maureen Fowler covers initial public offerings, also the capital markets at the Wall Street Journal, writing today about the extraordinary case of WeWork. Maureen, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, Kai.
Raise your hand if you've received a Chinese language robocall lately. Actually, wait. Raise your hand if you haven't, because they do seem to be everywhere. The Federal Trade Commission says they started a couple of years ago, these calls did, but they have really been ramping up. And more to the point, they have duped victims out of millions of dollars. Marketplace's Scott Tong. Once upon a time, our man in Shanghai decided to do a little investigating.
Let me walk you through a Chinese robocall. I get them all the time, so I record one. And sure enough, my phone rings and I hear this canned message. To translate, the voice claims to be from Bank of America, that I might have a problem and I should press zero. I play along. And then a live person comes on. You're about to hear her saying, "Hello, Bank of America," and me acknowledging her.
Bank of America, shema.
As a scammer, she doesn't seem very good. She claims to be calling from bank headquarters in New York, though the real HQ for B of A is in Charlotte. She checks the spelling of my first name.
S-C-O-T-T, shima.
Then appears to check the computer. But who really types this fast? Finally, the hook. Mr. Tong, she says, your name was found on illegally sold debit cards at the Shanghai airport, but we're here to help, and we can transfer you to the Chinese police to clear your name. It may cost a few bucks to straighten it out. At this point, the line goes dead. I'm not sure why, but now I'm speaking Chinese. To nobody. The scam didn't work on me, but the reality is it works on plenty of people.
They've lost huge, huge amounts.
Monica Vacca at the Federal Trade Commission tracks Mandarin robocalls.
One person has reported losing his entire life savings, more than $900,000. Other people have reported losing $20,000, $50,000.
Why does this scheme work? Aaron Foss at the call blocking company NomoRobo says Mandarin robocallers use proven techniques, like duping caller ID to make the call seem local.
It's as easy as putting on a mask. You set that caller ID to be anything that you want, and it's really just a couple of lines of code, and boom, it looks like the guy down the street is calling.
The bad guys can dial and dial and dial. And if the people who pick up don't speak Chinese, so what? The calls are practically free to make.
It's really just as simple as getting a server and getting a shady phone company to give you phone service, and then blast these calls out, millions of calls every single day.
Now, it's important who the callers claim to work for. Remember on my call, the woman said she was from Bank of America?
Bank
of America, 美国银行是吗?
It's a well-known corporation. Psychologist Stacy Wood at Scripps College studies scams and emotions.
It's kind of an essential principle of persuasion research. When we see a familiar name, a name that we trust, we tend to find it more credible.
What's also credible? That a phone scammer is calm, corporate. That's how my caller was.
The cold business-like approach can actually be very effective because there's fewer red flags that it's a scam.
And as my caller did, it helps to mention the cops, especially for robocallers targeting Chinese nationals in America. Virginia attorney Michael Lau almost fell for one of these calls himself. He has lots of clients from China.
People in the United States might not understand the same way simply because you are innocent until proven guilty. But in China, I think once they bring you in, essentially you have to prove your innocence. So they will be scared.
Aaron Foss at Nomo Robo says these scams originally targeted Chinese-speaking neighborhoods, but they work so well they've expanded to all of our phones. And no do not call list is going to help.
They're not real companies. It would almost be like having a do not murder me list, right? Please do not steal my money list, right? That's ridiculous. The criminals are not going to be respecting that.
The FTC would not talk about what it knows about the scammers, but says the calls could be coming from anywhere in the world. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Disappointing was the word that many of these companies consistently say.
Billions of dollars and precious little diversity to show for it. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 39 points today, a 10%, 26,788 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ down 58.7 tenths%, finished at 8104. The S&P 500 gave up 10 points, 3 tenths%, 29.95 there. That bad third quarter news from Hasbro that Mario Segarra was telling us about earlier. The toy maker missed both revenue and profit estimates. Shares ended the day down nearly 17%. Competitor Mattel gave up 6.5%. From the Department of Sensible Partnerships, this one, Stamps.com, announced it's teaming up with UPS. The postage retailer is going to offer discounts on UPS shipping. Stamps.com picked up 19% on that news. A little bit more, actually. UPS, meanwhile, down 2%. Bonds rose, yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.76%, and you are listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We just did the numbers to which you were hopefully listening attentively. But the fact is, there's a whole lot more to those indices than you can get across in 45 seconds of just talking. Like, as just one example, when I say the S&P 500 closed at 29.95 today, what does that actually mean?
It's not as simple as it might seem because it depends on what index you're talking about.
Andrea Eisfeld teaches finance at UCLA. And to make things simpler, for this installment of Kai Explains, where we take things real slow to figure out what's really going on, we are going to do the S&P 500.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
You recently asked what's going on with this economy.
So how do these two concepts work together?
The S&P 500 tracks 500 of the biggest companies in this economy as measured by market capitalization.
You just take the price of those S&P 500 stocks times the number of shares outstanding.
So?
If you have a stock like Apple, you just take its price.
Today, Apple closed at $239.96 a share.
And then you multiply it by the number of shares that are traded on U.S. stock exchanges.
Give or take 4.5 billion shares of Apple.
And then you have their market cap.
For Apple, that's a bit more than $1 trillion as of the close today. The thing about the S&P is that it's market cap weighted. So a change in the price of Apple shares moves the index more than, say, a change in the price of Ralph Lauren shares does. So how does that get us to the $29.95 that the S&P closed at today? Well, in the most basic terms, The S&P adds up all the market caps for all of those 500 companies to get
the market cap of that stock index.
Kinda. There are some calculations done.
It's normalized as a way to get to a nice round number.
That calculation is technically called the divisor.
It is intended to make sure that the index accounts for the fact that stocks will split. So one share will split into two shares of equal value. So it is meant to be able to compare the index at two different points in time.
It's not just the S&P that smooths things out, by the way. The Dow, which, as I think I have mentioned, is a price-weighted index, has a divisor as well. One last thing, and the last word, from Andrea Eisfeld at UCLA.
I think people should know what it means for the S&P 500 to be at a certain level, but I think it's more important to look at the percentage changes.
So just in case you drifted off somehow during the numbers, the S&P 500 today lost a little bit of steam headed into the close, down 0.3%. Let me know what else you might want to hear explained. Hit us up on Twitter. The show is at Marketplace. I am at Kai Ryssdal, KAIRYSSDAL. Just in terms of straight business sensibility, you'd think that if a couple of billion dollars is going to be spent on something, that something had doggone well better work. Such has not been the case in this economy to bring in more racial diversity, despite decades of promises to do so. And as I said, billions of dollars spent in the process. The results, says author Pamela Newkirk, are disappointing.
And that word disappointing was sort of like the word that many of these companies that do release reports consistently say.
Ms. Newkirk is a professor of journalism at New York University, and the idea that companies across industries are spending all that money on something that doesn't actually get results is the subject, by and large, of her new book. It's called Diversity, Inc. And what I asked her was, essentially, what gives?
Right. Well, there has been research that shows that the courts, when they are looking at discrimination lawsuits, that they pay more attention to the apparatus of diversity in the workplace than they do to the efficacy, the results of that apparatus. So I suspect that may have something to do with it, that these companies see the diversity infrastructure as a way of warding off lawsuits, or at least successful lawsuits. And I also think even those institutions that really do care about this, they think they can farm it out to a diversity czar as if the leadership doesn't have to be invested. And so if it's marginalized, if it's not rooted in the main of the corporate structure, the chances are it's not going to work.
What's interesting is that while at a systemic level, efforts to increase diversity have by and large been a failure, there are specific examples where companies have demonstrated they know how to do this and
exactly.
have been intentional about it. Tell me the story of Coca-Cola, because they occupy a good chapter or two in this book, and it's a good example.
Right. Well, Coca-Cola was sued for discrimination. It was a landmark settlement. And so they began to implement a structure in which they examined the metrics across the board, hiring, who got raises, who got bonuses. So they were able to make these interventions in real time. So it's very instructive to see the way a company can make change when there's intentionality from the leadership and when there's accountability.
So what do you want people to take away from this book? Because for a long time, the excuse, the rationalization was, well, we don't have enough people of color and minorities in the pipeline, and so those people aren't in decision-making positions yet. But now we have, broadly speaking, far more than we've had before, and yet we still have these challenges. So what's the takeaway here?
Exactly. We have decades of progress in this area, and it has a lot to do with how we look at people of color in this country, what we assume an elite organization looks like. I'm not writing about, you know, the Ku Klux Klan. I'm not writing about overt bigotry. But I am suggesting that we live in a pretty socially segregated society. If it's a overwhelmingly white world, that white world is going to be replicated in all of these elite fields and in these workplaces, because people hire who they know. They hire who they're comfortable with. And I think that that also has a large part to play in the dismal, abysmal numbers that we see year after year.
Pamela Newkirk, professor of journalism, also most recently the author of a book called Diversity, Inc. Ms. Newkirk, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We have, as we mostly always do, an excerpt from Diversity, Inc. at our website, marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, in which we get some tangible insight into that thing we say all the time on this program, that the American consumer is almost single-handedly keeping this economy going. This item from the National Retail Federation. Americans will spend this year, the NRF says, $490 million on Halloween costumes for their pets. Top choices in order: pumpkins, hot dogs, and superheroes. Don't at me, people. I love my dog. Just, in fact, two of them we've got. We just got a new puppy. We are not dressing them up. All right, we're done. Dow Industrials off 39 points today, about a 10%. The NASDAQ fell 58 points, 0.7%. S&P 500, now you know what the number means, 2995, gave up 10 points, 0.3%. Our digital and on-demand team includes Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Star Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.